motivation. Let's begin by really valuing our lives, valuing the potential we have with our lives, especially respecting ourselves because we have a kind heart and because we have aspirations to develop it and develop wisdom. So we have incredible potential as human beings. And then we've also met the Buddha's teachings that show us a step-by-step method on how to fulfill that potential, how to make our lives meaningful for all living beings. So while we have all these conditions together, let's really use them. And the best way to use them is to transform our mind, be able to release our anger and hatred and instead have love and compassion, to release our attachment and instead have a mind of generosity, to release our ignorance and replace it with wisdom. So let's engage on the path that teaches us how to do that and take this teaching seriously and put them into practice in our own lives. And for that reason, we're sharing the Dharma together this evening. Gomchen Lamrim. We're in this section about the four truths for the Aryas. Yeah. So four things that the Arya beings see as true and know both their conventional and their ultimate nature of these four. So we've already talked about the first one, the truth of unsatisfactory experiences in samsara. And now we're doing the one of the cause, their causes. Yeah. And so specifically what the Buddha pointed out as causes of all of our confusion and our unsatisfactory experiences are our mental afflictions, disturbing emotions and afflicted views, and also the karma, the actions that we do, motivated by them. And then the karma is what leads to the results that are unsatisfactory. So last time we were talking about the six, or sometimes it's called the 10, root afflictions. Okay, so can you name them? Don't look at your nose.
Attachment.
Anger.
Pride. That's right.
Arrogance.
Arrogance.
Ignorance.
Doubt.
Yeah. Afflictive doubt. And
wrong views. Distorted
views.
Afflictive views. And how many afflictive views are there?
Five.
What are they?
View of the personal identity.
Okay, the view of the personal identity.
Holding to the view of the two extremes.
Yeah, the view of the two extremes.
Holding those views as supreme.
Sometimes actually they that one's the third one is wrong view. And then holding them as supreme. And then the last one? Yeah, so holding wrong practices and wrong modes of conduct as supreme. Okay. So important that you remember what these are, because if we can't remember what they are, then there's no way we'll be able to locate them in our experience. And if we can't locate them in our experience, then there's no way to counteract them. Okay? So especially the ones, the different views are quite interesting, because we kind of think, oh, I have the right view. And then as we're going along, you know, all of a sudden this other idea comes in and it seems pretty good. And, you know, we're going back to, you know, what we learned when we're 5 or 6 years old about having a soul. You know, these kind of things, or, you know, predetermination, or God's will, or all the stuff that we thought we gave up, and then all of a sudden it's coming back in our mind. You know, maybe using Buddhist terminology, but it's still the same, you know, idea. So it's important to be able to locate these kinds of things when they pop up in our mind, okay? Especially the view of the personal identity where we have, you know, first the acquired view, then of course the innate view, but, you know, just thinking I am a separate person sitting here, kind of, yeah, controller of my world or controller of the world. Because the world is my world.
Someone said to me something this week about her Baptist background. She'd been watching videos of the Medicine Buddha. And sort of reminded me, I didn't remember this, but that teaching is that you are made uniquely, I mean, God makes you uniquely for a specific purpose, to do, use your talents in a certain way. So it's like, it's so totally much this grasping of personal identity and then living your power in the way of life.
Yeah.
I was surprised to be reminded of how specifically that is.
Right. You're a unique person with your own personality that God created, and there's a soul that goes on. Yeah. So all these kinds of views, we need to really scrutinize them and see if they can hold up under reasoning, or if they just fall apart because they don't make any sense. Yeah, quite important, you know, for Buddhist practitioners to do. It's not just a question of calming our mind and making ourselves peaceful. You know, we really need penetrative wisdom if we're going to, you know, eradicate the causes of our cyclic existence. Okay, so and then last time we also talked about the sequence in which they arise. Yeah, there's two different sequences according to which tradition you're following. And then this time we're going to talk about the disadvantages of the afflictions. Okay, so as we know, in the teachings, there's all sorts of sets of, these are the advantages of this, and these are the disadvantages of that. And, you know, it's the foundation of advertising, isn't it? but it works, and there's a reason for it, because if we don't understand the benefits of thinking about a certain thing, then we won't do it. And if we don't understand the disadvantages of not doing something else, then we'll continue to do it. Okay? So, affliction. So here we're talking about the ones that are views, and then also the ones that are non-views, they call them. Okay? So, Gomchen Lamrim, he starts out, the first disadvantages, they destroy you. That's a big disadvantage, isn't it? Yeah. So they don't destroy you, like, you know, dropping a bomb on you or anything. Not like that. But in terms of destroying your happiness, yeah, they cause big problems because, you know, clearly when we're very greedy and we want a lot of stuff, then we take things that belong to other people. They aren't very happy about it. That causes problems. Yeah. Or somebody does something we don't like and we get super mad at them and then we criticize them and talk badly behind their back and make fun of them. That creates problems. That destroys us too, doesn't it? Yeah. We get puffed up and arrogant. We hold our nose in the air. I'm so much better than you. Yeah. That attitude is not conducive towards happiness. And then jealousy. Jealousy is one of the worst ones. Ooh. I mean, jealousy is such a nasty emotion, isn't it? Because you feel so rotten and just you look at the state of your mind, because when we're jealous, we really want other people to be separated from their happiness and well-being. You know, we want them to suffer, and it's like, oh, what kind of mind is that when I want other people to be unhappy? That's not a very good state of mind. Okay, so, you know, we can see, again, that the afflictions destroy us. And the second disadvantage is they destroy others. You know, because when we act out of these afflictions, then clearly other people are unhappy. And they're miserable. Yeah, maybe we should share some experiences. What are the disadvantages for yourself and others? Think in your life, yeah, when you've been very, very attached to something or very greedy. What's been the disadvantage for yourself and for others?
People don't like you very much when they find out.
Yeah, people don't like you very much. Yeah. What else?
People don't trust you.
Yeah.
Your motives, why you do what you do,
yeah, yeah, they don't trust because, you know, we're greedy, what do we do when we're greedy? We kind of manipulate, we deceive, yeah? So it's not the basis for trusting relationships.
I think that lack of trust eventually morphs into fear. Not just lack of trust.
Yeah.
Not just fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Morphs into fear. And what does fear then bring forth?
Anger.
Anger. Yeah. So disadvantages for ourselves and others of anger? Do we even need to talk about it? I think people know, huh? We need to talk about it. Okay, what are the disadvantages?
We hurt others' feelings.
Yeah, we hurt others' feelings.
We're miserable.
Hmm?
We're miserable.
We're miserable. Are you sure we're miserable? When we're angry, we have so much energy. We're going to go out and get that guy who's harmed us. Doesn't that give you a sense of power? Doesn't it give you a buzz? I'm going to go get that idiot. No? No?
We say and do things that we regret with that energy.
Yeah, with that attitude. If we go out and do those things, then we really say and do a lot of things we're going to regret.
And then we think everybody around us is angry too.
Yes. Yes, because when we're angry, then everybody else is angry. And they're all out to get us. Yeah, it's not good for our immune system.
Or
getting to sleep at night, or your blood pressure, or
congestion.
Yeah.
The more we are angry, the more we have that affinity to become angry.
Yeah. Yeah, it becomes a habit.
Yeah.
And then any small thing, but what about arrogance? What are the disadvantages of arrogance? I mean, if you're really so good, what's wrong with letting other people know about it?
We make fools of ourselves.
Yes, we tend to inflate and we make fools of ourselves. Anybody have any good stories they want to share of doing that? You're all so quiet.
Come on. You first.
Exchange self with others. Okay, what happens when you get arrogant?
No one can stand you. Really, no one can stand being around you.
Yeah.
It's lonely.
Yeah, you wind up quite lonely, don't you?
You can't accept criticism or critique.
You can't accept criticism or critique, yeah. So quite ego-sensitive. Always doing a song and dance to impress others?
I think when I get arrogant, it's like, well, I can do that. And then 2 minutes later, it's like the situation comes up, and wait a minute, I can't do that. And everybody can see how silly I was.
Yeah.
And it's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, it is. And what about jealousy? Yeah. Pride, they don't like you. Jealousy, they really don't like you.
Oh, nasty feeling. It just feels awful.
Oh, yeah. Jealousy is like one of the most painful. It's just like...
Yeah. I think
so,
too.
When you're angry, it's not painful until you're just sort of crazy with it. But jealousy is painful all the way.
Yeah. Quite through and through. Yeah, it's a very sneaky energy. Yeah.
It's very much the opposite of cherishing others.
Yeah, quite the opposite.
So it isolates us.
Yeah, yeah. Very isolating, isolated. We also tend to feel sorry for ourselves when we're jealous. Yeah, when we get stuck in that.
Our speech goes down the tubes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Our speech is horrible when we're jealous. We can't say anything nice at all.
We even feel guilty about what we're thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't even like our thoughts. Yeah. Yeah. I have a little slogan of, you know, be careful of who you're jealous of, because if you get their life, you may not like it. Yeah? When you really look at the lives of the people that you're jealous of, often they have really bad problems. Yeah? That aren't much fun. And if we actually opened our mind, we would see some of those problems, and our jealousy would, you know, it's like throwing cold water on a hot fire.
You know, that's sort of a trap for me, too, because I look at these people that have things and say, oh, well, they're really not happy because, you know, they must be
miserable.
You know, where I don't have any of those things, but I'm happy.
Yeah. Yeah, so you replace jealousy with arrogance. Yes. Yeah, the antidote to jealousy. Views have on you and on other people.
to learn and be curious and to be open-minded.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Oh, when we're really caught in believing either the way that we exist or the world exists in a certain way, when somebody has a different idea about how that might be, we're not open to it because it's too threatening to how we really see mm-hmm. or how we think things exist. And we're really defensive and, you know, really put them down and don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Okay, so when we have very strong wrong views, or it could be any of the five, any of them, and somebody comes and tries to give us some other kind of information, we are completely unwilling and unable to let any other thought in, because we feel ego-threatened, you know. We're clinging to our wrong views so much that somebody else tries to say something else, and we just are like, oh, you know, our whole identity gets threatened by it.
It's a form of attachment.
Yeah.
It's dogmatic.
Hmm? Or will you get angry too?
Dogmatic.
Yeah.
People go to war.
You bet. Yeah, when you study history, people go to war not only over land and money and property, but over views.
Honor.
And honor. Yeah. Yeah.
Just creating so much negative karma, thinking that you're doing good.
Yeah.
That's just tragic.
Okay. Yeah, because you think your views are right, you think you're benefiting other people. It's that cow walking, you know, down the off the cliff, and everybody else following them, and you think you're doing something good and benefiting other people, but actually harming them.
And you're killing the name of God.
Right? Yeah, killing in the name of God. This is... I studied history at university. By the time I became a senior, you know, well, I didn't even need to wait until I became a senior. All you need is one European history class. And it's like, I don't want any part of religion because every generation people killed each other in the name of God. You know, and it hasn't stopped. It hasn't stopped. You know, so you can really see people's wrong views of their own religions.
The views can lead to a lot of the afflictions that aren't views, partially through like thinking, oh, I'm going to kill because somebody's defended my view, but sometimes just because you can have the wrong view that anger benefits me, mm-hmm. my attachment benefits me, and those are...
Right. Yeah, so it's interesting how the views can produce a lot of the non-views. Yeah, we create a whole way of thinking, oh, my anger benefits me, my attachment benefits me, attachment is going to make me successful, anger is going to protect me from enemies, so we develop a whole set of wrong views that support our disturbing emotions. And then the disturbing emotions go crazy. And, yeah. But it's very interesting to look at how often we create all sorts of theories and views that produce these kinds of emotions that cause us a lot of problems. Okay, then another disadvantage of the afflictions, they destroy your ethical discipline. Yeah, they do, don't they? Yeah, when we look at our, you know, when we transgress our precepts, what are the motivations? Very often attachment, yeah, or anger, or confusion. Here, confusion being the confusion over karma, the ignorance over karma and its effects. Yeah. So we break our precepts, or even if somebody who doesn't have precepts does all kinds of negative things, but, you know, justifies them, rationalizes them. Sometimes to the point where what we're doing is is creating negative karma, but we believe what we're doing is creating virtue. And if you study, you know, when you study societies where there's dictatorships or, you know, things like that, it's like the people, I mean, I'm thinking here of when the communists took over China. They had a philosophy of, yeah, we're going to make everything equal, and the poor people won't be poor, the rich people won't be rich, we're going to have much more equality. It's a beautiful, theoretical statement, yeah. But the way they went about it was very, very harmful and damaging to many, many people and created total chaos. Yeah. So the influence of views, the influence of attachment, anger. Yeah. I mean, all we need to do is read the newspaper. And we see so many examples, don't we, of how afflictions destroy our ethical conduct and destroy our happiness. Okay, the next one. Your property declines and is depleted. Now, how is that going to happen? How does that happen through having afflictions?
You make stupid choices.
Okay, you make stupid choices. What else?
Spend all your money on distracting yourself.
Yeah, you spend your money distracting yourself. What else?
If you don't practice generosity, then you won't be able to have resources in the future.
Yeah.
You're so attached to your money that you're not able to practice generosity.
Yeah, so you're so attached that you use up all of your good karma in this life without creating good karma for the future lives. And instead, you know, the afflictions make us create a lot of negative karma now that will ripen in future lives. Yeah. It's very interesting when we think of the disadvantages here. We always think of the disadvantages in this life. It's important that we also think of the disadvantages for future lives and for our spiritual practice. Those are quite important too, not just this life. Okay? Then, teachers and protectors admonish you. So how does that come about? Through having afflictions.
Because they're kind.
Because they're kind? Well, they help us. Do we... take in their kindness?
Not while we're
retroactively. Not while we're... Yeah, retroactively, 10 years later. You know. Oh, yes, they kind of knew. Okay, yeah, so we get admonished by the wise, you know, which is actually, we're fortunate if the wise admonish us. Because then we can learn something. But, you know, we have to be able to take it in.
That's true for our parents, too, right?
Yeah, it is. I want to tell you a secret, but you don't listen, okay?
You want me to leave?
Yeah. No, just go like this. And tell your sister when she comes back. When I was a teenager, I thought my parents were pretty dumb. Yeah, that they didn't, they were nice, but they were kind of dumb. Some of the things they told me not to do. And, just keep your ears plugged. and it was really funny because I thought my parents were so dumb. And then as I got older, I realized that some of the things my parents told me were really smart. But I didn't realize that until quite a bit. Few years later. Yeah. Do you think your parents are dumb sometimes? No? That's good. Your parents give you good advice? Yeah, good. And you follow their advice? You follow their advice? Okay. Okay, so teachers and protectors admonish you. You quarrel, lose your reputation, and are born in a condition of non-liberty. Okay? So we quarrel with other people, then our reputation, oh no! Yeah? Because when we have a whole lot of afflictions, our reputation just goes way down, doesn't it? Yeah? Either that or we have a huge following. But, yeah, and we're born in a condition of non-liberty, you know, because the more we have act out of afflictions, more negative karma we create, more we're born in conditions that are where we don't have freedom. You lose the virtue that you gained and prevent the creation of virtue you haven't yet gained, and also you're despondent. So these two may go together. If you believe in karma, then you're despondent about, you know, destroying your merit. If you don't believe in karma, then anyway, when you have a lot of afflictions in your mind, you're despondent. Yeah, you feel really crummy. But, you know, especially to think of what the afflictions do in terms of the virtue that we have created. Because we work really hard to create virtue, yeah? And then we get angry, and it's like, zoop, you know? We just destroy it. And we don't realize the disadvantages because we're so busy being angry that we never think, oh, I'm destroying my own merit. I'm destroying the causes of my own good rebirth. When I finally stop and I become aware of it, then I ask myself, okay, this person who I'm mad at, are they so important that I'm going to destroy my merit for them? Is my anger at them so worthwhile that I'm willing to destroy my merit? Yeah. And then the answer is clearly no. Yeah. Because anyway, when we're mad at them, we think they're a jerk. So, I mean, are you going to give up your merit for the sake of a jerk? Yeah, you don't want to give it up for the sake of anything. So then you just have to drop your anger and stop even seeing the person as a jerk. Because that whole view is what traps you. Okay, then we suffer from anxiety when we have a lot of afflictions. Our life becomes rather joyless. We tend to lack confidence. Yeah. And then we die with regrets. Yeah. Because when we have a lot of negative emotions, and we take them out on other people, then we don't feel good about ourselves, and at the time of death, that manifests as dying with regret. Which I think must be a really awful way to die. Then we wind up with an unfortunate rebirth. We're very far away from nirvana, and all of our spiritual aims are not fulfilled. Okay, so they say there's one good quality of afflictions. The one good quality is that they can be overcome. Aside from the fact that they can be overcome, they have no other good quality. Okay. So then the author says, reflect extensively and keenly on these drawbacks, and whenever any root or secondary affliction arises, be aware of it and think one has come and oppose it with antidotes. Okay? So when there's an affliction in your mind, I see it, gotcha! And then apply an antidote. Okay? Then the next section is how through these afflictions you accumulate karma. Okay? And so the first outline under this is identifying the karma to be accumulated. Okay? So the first part of this we covered before when we talked about karma. We talked about intention karma and intended karma. Okay? So when it says concomitant with the mind, it means that it's you have a primary mind and you have several mental factors that accompany that primary mind. Okay, that's what concomitant means. Sometimes they say the primary mind and the accompanying mental factors, or they'll say the mental factors that are concomitant with the mind. So it says concomitant with mind, the mental factor that is mental karma, which propels the mind towards its objects, is intention karma. Okay? So the grammar here is kind of funny. So what the question is, what is intention karma? Yeah? So you have a main mind, a primary mind, and it's the mental factor that's concomitant, that accompanies that primary mind, that propels the mind towards its objects, that directs the mind towards its objects. So it's the mental factor of intention. Yeah, which one is one of the five, what's the word? Five omnipresent. Yeah, the five omnipresent mental factors. Yeah, so there's these five, they come with every primary mind. One is intention, it directs the mind towards the object. So that mental factor of intention is karma, or it's mental karma. It's often what we call karma. It is, you know, that mental factor. Yeah. And then, it says, the physical and verbal karmas that are motivated by karma, by intention karma. Okay, so the intention karma is the mental factor in the mind, and the physical and verbal actions that are motivated by those, they're called intended karma. Okay, because they were intended by intention karma. Okay, so, and then also talking about the karma here, it says non-virtuous karmas are non-meritorious karmas, okay? Meritorious karmas are virtues that are found within desire realm beings, and immovable or invariable karmas are posited as polluted virtues and are found within beings of the form and formless realms. So we'll explain that. I wanted to go back to... Oh, I forgot this part here. Let me just go back to the faults of the afflictions, because there's some verses from Shantideva that are quite nice. Okay, so here's Shantideva telling us the faults of the afflictions. Enemies such as hatred and craving have neither feet nor hands, and are neither brave nor intelligent. How then have they enslaved me? Good question, isn't it? While they dwell within my mind, they are pleased to do me harm. They are not to be endured without anger. Tolerance of them is ridiculous. Okay, so we should really identify these disturbing emotions as our enemies and not be tolerant of them. even if all the gods and demigods should rise up as my enemies, they cannot lead me or force me into the fires of the unrelenting hell. But this powerful enemy, the afflictions, cast me in an instant into fires so hot that they would, so hot that if they met even Mount Meru, not even ashes would remain. Okay. So here, you know, saying even if all the sentient beings, including the celestial beings, rise up as our enemies, you know, everybody can't stand us, nobody likes us, they're all mad at us, that can't really harm us. That can't give us an unfortunate rebirth. Yeah, it makes us unhappy this lifetime. But what other people do, even people kill us, they can't make us have an unfortunate rebirth. But our own afflictions can. Yeah. And you can see this, you know, even if the whole world is against you and clobbers you and treats you awfully, if you haven't created negative karma, yeah, then how are you going to have a bad rebirth? Impossible. Even the whole world doesn't like you. Okay. On the other hand, even the whole world loves you. If your mind is filled with afflictions, and anger and jealousy and arrogance and so on, then your own mind sends you to the lower realms. Even all the people in the world love you and praise you and, yeah, make a big, beautiful funeral for you and say all those wonderful words about you that they never said when you were alive. But you're not around to enjoy it because you've already been born in the lower realms due to non-virtue. So this is very, very important, you know. Other people are not the problem. If we're unhappy, it's because what's going on inside of us. And it becomes real clear, you know, when you start to look at your lives. And it becomes clear when we look at the lives of other people too. You know, who are the people who are really strong in difficult situations that we admire? You know, why do we admire His Holiness or Nelson Mandela or Gandhi or any of these people? Why do we admire them? It's not because they vanquished external enemies. It's because, you know, they had a good heart and they subdued their own afflictions. The enemy that is my afflictions has lasted a long time without beginning and until now without end. No other enemy has the power to last for such a long time. So we get all inflamed about ISIS, and, you know, whichever political party you don't like, and, you know, you don't like ISIS, you don't like Assad, and you don't, you know, all inflamed about this person, that person. All these people are going to die at some point. Yeah, they're not going to last forever. They're here for a short time. Changing moment by moment, they're eventually going to die. And we don't even have to do anything to make that happen. That's just the natural thing. But our afflictions, yeah, unless we actively oppose them, they're just going to keep going on and on and on and on without any end. So this is good to remember when we get upset with other people and start blaming them for our unhappiness. Yeah, to remember that it's not due to other people, it's due to our own disturbing emotions. It's due to the wrong conceptions, the distorted conceptions we have in our mind. Given appropriate service and attention, everyone helps you and makes you happy. But if you serve your afflictions, they only inflict further suffering. Okay? So other sentient beings, it's always possible to create some kind of situation in which we get along, you know, and they'll serve us, and we can make them happy. That's always possible to do. But with our afflictions, if we serve them, there's no way that they're ever going to make us happy. Yeah. So we should really be on the lookout for the thieves, the internal ISIS. Yeah, we should make up something else that ISIS means.
Self. Important.
Suffering.
Self sabotage.
I. Self.
Internal
sabotage.
Internal sabotage is suffering.
Oh, internal sabotage is suffering. Yeah. Okay. So we can think a few of those, but that's the real enemy, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Then there's some interesting thing. I'm going to read from the Lam Rim Chenmo here. Quite interesting. Because usually we think about Vasubandhu, you know, when we study tenons, who's associated with a vibhasikas, Vasubandhu. Here, it's going to say the vibhasikas think one thing and Vasubandhu thinks another thing. This was part of the problem with the section I was working on last week, too. So, I don't know. But it says, the vibhasikas divide physical and verbal karma into two types, the perceptible and the imperceptible. Remember this? Revelatory and non-revelatory, depending on whether they reveal the intentions of the person or don't reveal. You know, whether you can perceive the intentions or not perceive the intentions. Okay, so they divide both physical and verbal, both physical and verbal karma have those two, perceptible and imperceptible. And the vibhasikas hold that both types also have form. Okay, so the perceptible karma would be with your speech, you could hear from somebody's tone of voice. You could perceive what their motivation was. The imperceptible part would be some kind of speech where you couldn't tell what their motivation was. Okay? The perceptible physical ones are, you know, you can see, you know, somebody's lifting their hand and, you know, you can see they're going to wave to somebody. You can tell their intention. Or imperceptible karma, like our precepts. They have form, but you know, you can't perceive the intention during the day, you know, when we're going around. Okay. So Vasubandhu refutes this, asserting that physical and verbal karma are intentions that work along with perceptible physical and verbal behavior. This is actually what the Sautantrikas believe. But Vasubandhu and Abhidharma Kosha, the first eight chapters were Vibhasika, the ninth chapter was Sautantrika.
Who figured that out?
Vasubandhu.
He stated that? No.
I don't know. I mean, that's what people say. And he wrote the Treasury of Knowledge to purify negative karma he had created by criticizing the Mahayana. Don't ask me. I don't understand. Okay? You would think he would have written like a Mahayana text to purify that negative karma. So, anyway. Okay, so what he's saying, that Vasubandhu refutes this, saying that physical and verbal karma are not form. They are that mental factor of intention. Okay? That accompany, that work along with perceptible physical and verbal behavior. So that would be like, you know, the physical and verbal karma would be your thought to praise somebody in order to make them feel good and acknowledge their good qualities, or your physical karma would be the thought, the motivation to, you know, haul off and slug somebody, you know, so, or bow down to somebody to make prostrations. So, you know, whatever the intention is that accompanies the physical, the perceptible physical and verbal behavior. Thus, both forms of karma, intention and intended, are actually intentions. Okay? In other words, that all, both of these forms of karma are the mental factor of intention. This is also what the Pali tradition says. They always say karma is not physical or verbal. It's the, you know, it's the actual intention that motivates the action. Okay? Okay, so then we're going to talk about meritorious, non-meritorious, and invariable karma. Okay? So, let me just shift here.
So all that is in the
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Lam Rim Chenmo, Volume 1, 303, at the bottom. The Prasangikas agree with the Vibhasakas about physical and verbal karma being form. You know, it has to do with what is the reason. It has to do with something like, what is it? You know, like you've done an action, but you don't accumulate the karma until later. For example, if you beat somebody up, but they don't die for another 2 days, you don't get the karma of dying for those other 2 days. So when you beat them up, you had a negative mind state, and the action, you know, was perceptible, and they all match, and the action was complete if they die right away. But if they die later, 2 days later, you could have a virtuous mind. You know, at that time, then they died. So then how do you collect the non-virtuous action of killing? Because you don't collect the karma of killing until the person dies. But if that moment they die, if you have a virtuous mind, how you can't also have a non-virtuous intention or a non-virtuous accumulation at that time happening simultaneously. So that's why they say it's form, because somehow you could still have a virtuous mind, but you get the form of the action of killing. It's something like that. I can't say it makes total sense to me, because this whole thing of perceptible and unperceptible form has, I've asked a lot of questions about it, and I still can't say I understand it well.
Is it a hidden phenomenon?
Well, the perceptible forms are we can see with our senses. The imperceptible ones, yeah, we can't see. Yeah. So they say, like our pratimoksha precepts, if we receive, in the Chinese they call it a precept body. Yeah, so it's you receive this imperceptible form, based on having the intention not to do those actions. And that imperceptible form acts like a dam that keeps you from transgressing the precepts. That's what they say.
How does it do that?
It's a phenomena that, you know, because we have six senses, our five physical senses, then the mental sense. So it's a phenomena for the mental sense. Yeah, which means that you're going to have some kind of special ability to perceive it.
Mm-hmm. Some kind of special ability. Does that mean that some beings may be able to perceive it?
Yeah. Yeah, probably beings with, you know, who have some kind of super knowledgeist, they'll be able to see it.
Kind of, what, force field?
Well, this is, you know, I ask questions about it, like what shape is it and what is it made out of? You know, and they say, well, it's made out of the very subtle elements. Well, what are those? Well, they say it's got to be made out of the very subtle elements because our pratimoksha precepts don't carry on with us to the next life. You know, why don't they? Because they're made of form, and at the time we die, the body and mind separate. So those precepts don't come with us. No, they're different. They're just the mental factor of intention. Yeah, they're different.
And so for ordination, we generate the precept body for all the different platforms.
Right.
But they all being Chinese, the Bodhisattva.
For the Bodhisattva, they set a precept body?
Yeah, but the Chinese tradition, of course, will explain that it is a seed in the eighth consciousness.
Oh, that's why. Yes. I see, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what the, Ruchi Damajo, what you would say. Okay, so meritorious, non-meritorious, and invariable, or unmovable, okay? I think invariable is better. Rather than unmovable. Okay, so the non-meritorious is non-virtue created in the desire realm, and it's going to bring, rebirth in the lower realms. Okay? Then, so that's called non-meritorious or demeritorious, okay? So it's created under the influence of both types of ignorance, the ignorance of ultimate truth and the ignorance of karma and its effects. Both of those ignorances play a role in creating non-meritorious karma. Meritorious action, one way of speaking of them is, here they're spoken of a slightly different way. Okay. Meritorious action is virtuous karma in the minds of beings of the desire realm. Okay? So you have a virtuous intention. It's leaving the seeds of virtuous karma, and it's going to result in good rebirths. So this is still polluted karma, because it's still karma created under the influence of ignorance. But here it's the ignorance of the ultimate nature, not the ignorance of karma and its effects. Okay? And so that's going to lead to good rebirths within samsara. Then invariable karma is polluted virtuous karma in the minds of beings of the form or formless realms. I think that's when their minds are in that realm, not that they're born in that realm. Okay, because invariable karma is what ripens as rebirth in one of the material or immaterial realms. So some people say it's actually a form of meritorious karma, But other people say meritorious karma is only for the desire realm, and invariable is for the material and immaterial realms. Why is it called invariable? Because when it's created, it will ripen only in that particular meditative absorption. Okay? So, like our karma in desire realm is variable. You could create a karma that, was going to, create a rebirth in a human body, but then in the bardo there's some change in factors or something happens, and that karma ripens, let's say, as a deva in the desire realm. Okay, so it's not variable in the sense that virtue still creates an upper rebirth, and non-virtue creates an unfortunate rebirth. It doesn't vary that way. But what exactly the virtuous rebirth is, or the unfortunate rebirth is, that can vary. Okay? So meritorious karma in the desire realm can vary. That's why when people die, we do pujas and we dedicate merit for them. Yeah, because that's an attempt to, help them and influence the ripening of their karma at that time. Okay. But for rebirth in the material and immaterial realms, then when you're a human being, you've done meditation, you've attained a certain level of concentration, one of the four material realms, one of the jhanas, or maybe one of the four immaterial realms, those meditative absorptions. And depending upon which one you attained as a human being, your action of your karma of attaining that will ripen in rebirth just as that particular level. So if as a human being you attain the first jhana, when you die, you will be reborn in the first jhana. You won't be reborn in the second or third or the immaterial realms, okay? Same with if you've attained one of the, let's say, the immaterial realm of, focusing on nothingness, then you're not going to be reborn in one of the four jhanas. Those are lower, or any of the other ones, okay? So those are called invariable for that reason. Yeah?
Do you have to die in that meditative absorption to be born in?
I have no idea. Are you going to have to die while you're in that realm? I mean, I would assume that somebody who has attained a realization like that would try to die while they're meditating.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But if they die, if they have an accident, I don't know. Okay, so I think that's good enough for that. Okay. Yeah, so there's a quote from, again, Treasury of Knowledge. Merit is the virtuous karma of the desire realm. Invariable karma produces the higher God realms. Okay? Okay. Then, let's go back to Gomchen. Okay, then the next section says, as Aryas do not accumulate fresh karma to be propelled into samsara, those who do accumulate it are ordinary beings from the supreme dharma level of the Mahayana path of preparation downwards. Okay, so here's the question people say. When do you stop accumulating non-virtuous karma? Okay? So, first of all, we have to talk about the hearers and solitary realizers. Yeah. So, in terms of the hearers and solitary realizers, they have realized emptiness. Okay? they can still create negative karma, you know, destructive karma, but not the destructive karma that's going to throw another rebirth in samsara. Okay? So, in other words, they still have afflictions that can manifest and create the destructive karma, but their afflictions are not powerful enough to create the destructive karma that would land them in an unfortunate realm. Okay? That's the stream enters and once returners. Okay? Then, for the bodhisattvas of the path of seeing and above, yeah, then what does it say here? They're definitely not going to create any negative karma that results in rebirths. Now, what's interesting here, yeah, because I've asked about this several times. It says, when it's talking about Mahayana practitioners, it says every ordinary person from the highest level of the supreme stage of the Mahayana path of seeing down accumulates karma that impels rebirth and cyclic existence. Okay, so accordingly, when those who are under the influence of afflictive ignorance and the view of the perishing aggregates become physically, verbally, or mentally involved in non-virtue, killing, for example, they accumulate non-meritorious karma. Those who perform virtuous actions within the desire realm, such as practicing generosity or maintaining ethical discipline, accumulate meritorious karma. Those who cultivate meditative states, such as meditative serenity, at the level of the meditative stabilizations of the form or the formless realm, material or immaterial realms, accumulate invariable karma. It does not say that Mahayana Aryas don't create any negative karma. Yeah, it says the stream enters and once returners can, but it's not strong enough to propel a rebirth. So clearly the Mahayana Aryas, it's not going to be strong enough to propel a rebirth if they create it, but it doesn't say whether they create it or not, that topic is avoided. And I've asked about it several times, and people are going, well, let's see, could they, couldn't they? Well, they could, but if they do, it's got to be something very minor. Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine somebody who's realized emptiness creating negative karma. But the stream enters and once returners have. And in fact, sometimes when you hear the descriptions of the stream enters, it's rather surprising. You know, because the eight worldly concerns can still be active in them. Yeah, and they can, you know, they can be possessive and all sorts of things. It's really rather surprising. Yeah, once returners, because they're only going to be born in the desire realm once more, then their afflictions are going to be much less. But again, both of them can create the non-virtue, because remember, the non-virtue is associated with the desire realm. Yeah. But once returner is only going to be born in desire realm one more time, so that karma is going to be very weak. Once you get to non-returners, then you're not going to have that. Okay. But they don't say about Arya Bodhisattvas. Okay. Now, there's some interesting things here. So, somebody raises a qualm. Consider someone who has seen the faults of all worldly wonders and is motivated by an aspiration for liberation. So somebody who's realized the first principle aspect of the path. Doesn't this person create much virtuous karma? Moreover, consider the virtuous karma that is an intention similar to a wisdom consciousness, actually analyzing the meaning of selflessness. So, for example, on the path of seeing, you don't have a direct perceiver of emptiness, but you do have a very powerful inferential cognizer of emptiness. So,
huh?
No, I said on path of preparation. Okay. On path preparation, you have that? Okay, so here's, so they're asking somebody who has renunciation, first principle aspect path, somebody who has an inferential realization of emptiness, such as on path of accumulation or path of seeing, don't they create a lot of good karma? Is this a true origin, a cause of cyclic existence? Okay. Reply. In general, those who are on the paths of accumulation and preparation do accumulate ordinary karma that impels rebirth. First two paths, you haven't realized emptiness, you accumulate karma that's going to impel rebirth. However, motivations based on thoughts, such as those you describe, as well as virtuous karma similar to the wisdom that analyzes selflessness, constitute the group of remedies for the craving for future existence. In other words, renunciation and that inferential cognizer of emptiness, they belong to the group of remedies of the that remedy the craving for future existence in samsara. Okay? So they have some good qualities there. Yeah, they constitute the group of remedies. Further, in both their objective and subjective aspects, so in terms of what they perceive and how they perceive it, they operate in a manner contrary to the conception of self, the root of cyclic existence. So both renunciation, the inferential understanding of emptiness, operate opposite to how view of personal identity and ignorance operate. That makes sense. Okay. Thus, they are not actual or usual true origins that impel rebirth. They're not the actual ones. However, yes, but... They are not, however, because they approximate actual true origins leading to a future rebirth, they are included among true origins. Then the question comes, how do they approximate actual true origins? In what way are they similar to actual true origins? Okay. They still have ignorance as a motivation, and they still are tainted by the latencies of ignorance. So that's how they're going to resemble actual true origins. Even though, yeah, they're not actual or usual true origins that impel rebirth. So it's kind of, you know, you're in a situation where you can't say that they're unpolluted karma because they are, the mind that's creating them is still influenced by ignorance and the latencies of ignorance. But on the other hand, they're very much going directly towards gaining the direct realization of emptiness. So you can't say they're just like ordinary, ordinary meritorious karma either. You've got to put them in a special class somehow. So this is how it's done. Yeah, they are still included among true origins, but they're not actual or usual true origins that impel rebirth. Okay, that's how you do it.
What page is that?
305. Okay. Okay, then, a few paragraphs after that, he says, you may not have acquired through extensive meditative analysis of the faults of cyclic existence the remedy that eradicates the craving for the wonders of cyclic existence. In other words, you may not have generated renunciation of samsara. Anybody here fall into that? Okay. Also, you might not have used discerning wisdom to properly analyze the meaning of selflessness and might not have become familiar with the two bodhicittas, conventional and ultimate. Okay, anybody here who fits that description? Okay. But we're practitioners, aren't we? Yeah, we're practitioners. We're trying. Under such circumstances, your virtuous activities, with some exceptions on account of the field's power, this is that line that Geshe Nawang Samdhan, or the Geshe Dadal told us. He said it was a very small thing. This is it. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Okay, under such circumstances, your virtuous activities, with some exceptions on account of the field's power, in other words, if your action is involving a holy object, okay, otherwise, yeah, all these actions would constitute typical origins of dukkha and hence would fuel the process of cyclic existence. So we're Dharma practitioners, we're trying, we're doing our best, we're still creating karma that is fueling the process of rebirth in samsara. Because we're not free of rebirth from samsara yet. Yeah? So even our virtue is good, but it's creating the, and we're dedicating it for supreme awakening, but it's the kind of virtue that will ripen in a good rebirth in samsara. But it's also putting lots and lots of good imprints on our mind so that one day, you know, that won't be the case. Okay? The only exceptions are that thing of when you're working with a holy object, you know. Because they say by the power of the holy object, then that kind of virtue will ripen in awakening. Yeah. So that's why we, you know, create holy objects, we bow, we make offerings, all these kinds of things.
But okay. That's still considered contaminated karma too, because that mind is contaminated?
It doesn't say. It would seem to me it's still contaminated because, you know, still polluted because your mind is ignorant. But it has some special power because of the it's being a holy object. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? So there's a lot in this. Isn't there? Quite a bit to think about. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing you'll have to review your notes and look up and think about it and try and understand it a bit. And if you didn't understand much, that's okay. You're walking in the middle of a text. I don't expect to understand everything.
So there will be information on the perceptible, imperceptible karma, is that also in the
Longer Chenpo? Yeah, that was the part I read, was I think on the preceding page. That was on 303. Yeah, 303.
Volume 1.
Pardon?
Volume 1.
Volume 1. Uh-huh.
You said the Prasangika hold that view also with the perceptible and imperceptible.
Yeah.
Is there any differences between the way those two schools hold that?
Is the what?
Is Are there it? Any differences between the way those two schools hold those?
Yeah, they hold them for different reasons. But again, it's not, that whole topic is not super clear. I've asked a lot. I have a file with notes. And hakomason, which means I don't understand.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Namandala Kamriyatayami.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti and